Well, if you were here last week, you know, last week we started a new five-week series called Baseball and Barbecues, and the whole idea was, what if we took the second greatest commandment literally, which is to love your neighbor as yourself, and what if we said we're going to love our literal neighbors in our neighborhoods as ourselves? In other words, what if we took the word neighbor, which is a noun, and we turned it into a verb? And if you were here last week, you know, we looked at the story of the Good Samaritan, and we saw in that story that the term neighbor really applies to anyone in need. But the problem with that is we can so globalize and generalize the term neighbor that we exclude people who live right next door to ourselves. And so when we think about loving our neighbor, maybe the place for us to start is in our actual neighborhoods with our actual neighbors. And if you remember last week, I gave you three practical steps. And the first one was to fill out your neighborhood map and to go home and on the back write down the information you knew about those neighbors in your neighborhood. And the second was do a couple of prayer walks around your neighborhood. And the third was to set a date for a neighborhood barbecue. And I wonder how you did with that. We did well. We've set a date. July 1st is our neighborhood barbecue. And as I walking my dog, I did prayer walks around our neighborhood several times this week. And then I found out that I know a lot more about some of my neighbors than some of my other neighbors. And so we've made it a goal to get to know some of our neighbors better this summer. And I know what some of you are thinking as we talk about this whole idea of going into our neighborhoods and building relationships with our neighbors. You're saying, where on earth am I going to get the time for this? Are you kidding me? Follow me around. I get up early in the morning. I drive the kids to school. Then it's off to work. Then it's come back, pick up the kids, go home. We got to get dinner into their mouths before we race off to the baseball diamond where I feel like I live. I come home. The kids do their homework. I drop into bed, repeat the next day. And then we get to the weekends, and they're no more calmer. And then we make you wake up your family nice and early to get here for the 9:30 service. And you're going, I can't fit any more in. And you know, I can feel your pain. I do work more than one day a week, believe it or not. I know what it's like. And I thought, oh, when I get to the empty nest stage, it'll get slower. It hasn't. And most people are not walking around with a lot of extra time. For most of us, our days are packed already. It's hard enough to maintain the relationships that we have, never mind adding more. And so some of you are thinking, even though that's a great idea, I'd love to get to know my neighbors better. How on earth am I ever going to find the time? Well, I think all of us here this morning, or most of us anyway, would agree that the healthiest person that ever lived was Jesus. Without a doubt, he was the healthiest person that ever lived. And yet, if you read the Gospels, you see that he was a pretty busy guy. And yet, as you read the Gospels, you see that Jesus was never hurried. It seems like he always had time for people and their needs. And so maybe we can learn something from Jesus this morning about finding time and meeting needs. I want us just to walk through a story this morning in Mark chapter 5 and then just take a couple of applications out of it for us. Mark chapter 5, and here's what it says. It says, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and he pleaded earnestly with him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so she will be healed and live. So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. Jesus is with his disciples in the Galilee region. At the beginning of Mark chapter 5, he casts the demon out of a guy. And then Jesus and some of his disciples get back in a boat and they cross over and they go to the area of Capernaum. And as they get close to shore, a crowd gathers, a large crowd. And you can just imagine, they're pushing and they're jostling to get a look at this miracle worker as he comes to shore. And a guy named Jairus had heard the miracle worker was coming, and so he hightailed it down to the seashore. And Jairus was a synagogue leader, a person of high social standing. Everyone would have known who he was. He was also the father of a 12-year-old girl. And after Jesus comes ashore, Jairus pushes his way through the crowd and he falls at Jesus' feet and he pleads, "Jesus, I need you to come to my home. My little girl is about to die." Think of the emotion in that moment. Imagine your child is on the verge of death. Imagine pleading with Jesus. And Jesus agrees to this interruption. And he starts to move in the direction of Jairus' house. But the crowd is large and they're pressing in. Have you ever experienced a crowd like that? Where it's hard to move? I was at the final night of Expo 86. 400,000 people on the Expo grounds in Vancouver. You couldn't take a step without bumping into anyone. Crowd pressuring in. Not somewhere to be if you're claustrophobic. And that's the kind of crowd here. They're just pressing in. And Jesus is trying to make his way through. And then it says in verse 25 this. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. Because she thought, if I can touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. And once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, he turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Here's Jesus. He's struggling to make his way through this crowd. And you can just imagine Jairus, the daughter's dad, he's frantic. He knows his daughter's life is hanging in the balance. And he's wondering, why won't these people just get out of the way and let Jesus walk through the crowd? He knows that every minute counts. And now in the crowd is this woman. And she also is desperately trying to move through the crowd to get to Jesus. She's been hemorrhaging from a private part of her body for 12 years. For over a decade, she's experienced pain and ill health. She's gone to doctor after doctor. She's had treatment after treatment. She spent all her money. And things haven't got better. They've just got worse. 12 years of ill health. Some of you here know what that's like. And Jewish law stated that when your monthly period came, a woman was sequestered and considered ceremonially unclean. For this woman, it had been going on for 12 years of her life. For 12 years, she had been considered unclean. For 12 years, she had been marginalized. For 12 years, she had been rejected. And now, she's moving through this crowd to get to Jesus. He is her last hope. And she gets close enough to reach out and touch his cloak. And suddenly, Jesus stops in his track. You can just imagine all the people bumping into one another, can't you? And Jesus says, "Who's touched my garments?" And I love the disciples' response. "Are you kidding me, Jesus? We're in a moving mosh pit. Look around you. Who touched your garments?" And Jesus said, "Someone touched me. Power went out of me." Meanwhile, this woman's probably trying not to be noticed and trying to shrink back into the crowd. After all, she's been rejected for 12 years. Yet Jesus is looking through the crowd. And you can just see it when their eyes meet. You can just see her putting up her hand, can't you? And she falls through the crowd and she falls at his feet and she is afraid and she tells him the whole truth. The word there literally means the whole story. Have you ever met people that want to tell you the whole story? My wife's like that with movies. She'll come to bed. I'll say, was it a good movie? Oh, yes, it was a great movie. It was about these people. I just want to know if it was a good movie. But I'll have a 15-minute recap of the movie. I just wanted a yes or no. And here's this woman. She's telling the whole story. Jesus, well, I went to this doctor, and he did this, and went to this doctor, and I went at this treatment, I had that treatment. Imagine Jairus and what he's thinking and feeling. He's pacing as the woman goes on and on. He's like, come on, Jesus, come on. Let's get going. All he could think about was his daughter's life. And imagine the disciples. They're like, come on, Jesus. You're holding up Jairus. He's an important guy. Heal his daughter. We'll get some major press. This is just a woman. That's how they thought back then. Sorry. But this is just a woman. Jairus is an important guy. Come on. Yet can't you imagine Jesus kneeling down, taking that woman's face in his hands, and he says, daughter, that is a very intimate term. He says, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Go in wholeness. Go in life. You're freed from your suffering. No peace. All the things that she had not known for the last 12 years. The outcast is made whole because Jesus decides to stop. He restores her not just to health, but he restores her to community and relationship. She is made well because Jesus was willing to be interrupted. But there's another story that's going on here. It's the story of Jairus and his daughter. And look at verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? Overhearing what they said, Jesus told them, don't be afraid, just believe. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him. And after he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and he said to her, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately, the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. A group comes along and they've got these long, ashen faces. And they say to Jairus, Jairus, it's too late. Why annoy the teacher any longer? Your daughter has died. Do you see what's happened? The woman's interruption cost Jairus' daughter's life. Enter into that moment with Jairus for the moment. What would you be thinking? What would you be feeling? Some of you know the pain of hearing the word, your child has died. Then Jesus says, don't be afraid. Are you kidding, Jesus? Don't be afraid. He says, just believe. Just trust me. And Jesus tells the crowd to stay put, and he takes Peter, James, and John and heads over to Jairus' house. And as they get near, they can hear the crying, and they can hear the wailing. And Jesus walks up, and he says, what's all the commotion about? And they say, Jairus' daughter is dead. And he says, she's not dead. She's just sleeping. And the crowd starts to mock and to laugh, and Jesus kicks them all out of the house. And now it's just mom and dad and the three disciples, Jesus and a dead 12-year-old. And Jesus approaches the bed, and lying there is this lifeless little girl. And he takes her cold hand and he says, little girl, I say to you, get up. And suddenly her chest heaves and she takes a breath and her eyes open and her skin starts to lose its ashen gray color. And she stands and she starts to walk around. And it says the mom and the dad and the disciples were astonished. No kidding. And then Jesus says, "Oh, mom, get your daughter something to eat. She's hungry. Because she's just come back from the dead." That's an amazing story. That's an incredible story. And you may say, yeah, it's a good story. But what do we take away from it when it comes to loving our neighbors? I think there's two wonderful lessons for us in this story about loving other people, and in particular, loving our neighbors. Here's the first one, and it's very clear in the story. Jesus is the life giver. Jesus is the life giver. The woman was dead socially. The girl was dead physically. And Jesus gave them both life. Jesus is the life giver. Do we believe that? Do we really believe that Jesus gives life? Do we believe that Jesus can breathe life into dead relationships? That Jesus can heal? That his power, his love, his grace can do amazing, life-transforming things in people's lives, in people's neighborhoods? Show of hands this morning. How many of us believe that our neighbors need to be touched by Jesus, the life giver? Show of hands. All right, almost all of you. So you other people don't believe that Jesus can be the life giver, or you're sleeping. It could be one of either. Here's the deal. It's true. Jesus is the life giver, and the truth is our neighbors need Jesus to breathe life into their lives, into their families, into their marriages. Our neighbors, they need to know Jesus, the life giver. And here's the deal, he wants to bring life to them. Jesus wants to bring life to our neighbors, and he wants to do it through you and me. He wants to work through you to bring his healing, his life to your neighbors and to your neighborhoods. But for that to happen, two things need to happen. First, you need to know Jesus, the life giver. And secondly, you need to have the time. And that's the second lesson we see in this story. Not only is Jesus the life giver, but Jesus had the time. Did you notice that? Jesus had the time. Jesus was a busy guy, but he always seemed to have the time for people. It seemed every encounter and every individual, no matter how insignificant, mattered to him. Here he is. He's getting out of a boat. Jairus throws himself at his feet, says, "I need you." And he starts to head. That's interruption number one. On the way to his house, a woman touches him, and he deals with that. Interruption number two. Jesus always had the time for people. The question for us is, how can we live like Jesus? If Jesus wants to breathe life, breathe his healing, breathe his love and grace through you into your neighborhoods, into your neighbors' lives, if he wants to use you to be a vessel for his life-giving grace and love in your neighborhood, then how can you have the time like he had the time? Let me give you three simple suggestions this morning. Here's the first one. Don't miss the point. If you're a leader, I've read an excellent book lately. It's called The Entrepreneur Roller Coaster by Darren Hardy. Highly recommended if you're in business or if you're a leader. It's a great book. But in the book, Darren Hardy tells the story of meeting his dad's mentor. Well, they'd met before, but having one final meeting with his dad's mentor. His dad's mentor was a man who coached college football, and after his college football career, went into real estate. And after several years, coach, as Darren called him, had amassed a vast fortune in real estate. He had hundreds of real estate holdings, and he got a ton of money from them. And Darren went to visit Coach one final time because Coach was on his deathbed dying of cancer. And Darren says they had a great meeting. It lasted about an hour. And then Darren was getting ready to go. And Coach reached up his hand and grabbed Darren's forearm, looked him in the eye and said, "Darren, don't miss the point." I'll let Darren Hardy pick up the story as he tells it. "Don't miss the point? I wasn't sure I understood. What point had I missed? Had there been a point?" Coach continued, "I had houses, too many houses. What I needed was more people, more relationships." He took a breath. "I invested money, money, heart. I should have been investing my heart." Took another breath. With this one, I saw his eyes turn watery blue. "I was keeping the wrong score, Darren. I was playing the wrong game." At that moment, the former football coach, the real estate magnate, the man at the very end of his life, released his grip on my arm. He lay his head back on the pillow and, staring blankly at the ceiling, said one last time to me or to himself, "I'll never know. Don't miss the point." I don't want any of us in this room to get to the end when you're lying on your deathbed and go, "I missed the point." And as followers of Jesus, what is the point? Well, Jesus tells us, let me read these same verses I read to you last week, because Jesus tells us what our purpose in life is, what our point is. Here it is: "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it: love your neighbor as yourself." What's the point? What's the purpose of our lives as followers of Jesus? It's to love God and it's to love ours. How do we do that? By living 6-8 lives, by walking humbly with Jesus and loving him, and then walking into our neighborhoods and our workplaces and our schools and saying, "We're going to be people who love other people," by acting justly, by compassionately serving, by allowing God to pour his love and grace through us and to touch others' lives. Think about your life for a moment. What's the point of your life right now? What is the point of your life right now? What should be the point? The reason Jesus was able to keep his focus is because Jesus knew what the point was. The point was to love God and love others. And when you understand what the point is, and you keep your focus on the point, it's to love Jesus and let him love others through us, it keeps us focused. And it allows us to get to the end of our lives and say, "I didn't miss the point. I loved my neighbors as myself." In order to do that and keep your focus on the point, you have to look at your schedule. How many of you ever say, "I'd love to engage my neighbors when things slow down, when I have more time"? I used to say that about all kinds of things. "I'll get out and do more fishing when things slow down." Here's what I know about life: things will slow down when I die or when I get intentional about my schedule. Those are the only way things are going to slow down. Let me ask you, what is the pace and the rhythm of your life? You see, it's very hard to love people well and build healthy relationships when we're always busy, when we're always in a hurry, and we're living lives with crammed schedules. I know that all too well. I've just come through a season in my life where for the last 6-7 months, I've been working 70 hours plus a week. And I finally sat down with the elders at our recent meeting. I said, "Okay, we got to dial this back a bit for a number of reasons." But one of the reasons was, I can't build healthy relationships at that speed. I can't go into my neighbor's life at that speed. And so we've had to make some adjustments so I can slow down. If we want to build healthy relationships, if we want to love people well, we can't be traveling at Mach speed. If we want to engage our neighbors, we're going to have to make some adjustments. So maybe it's time for you to sit down on your patio with the birds singing, with a cup of coffee and your calendar, and say, if the main point is loving God and loving others, what adjustments do I need to make? Here's a third little thing that I think we can learn here. Be interruptible. Most of us tend to see life's interruptions as bothersome and annoying, don't we? I mean, there's a guy in our neighborhood, I'll call him Frank, not his real name, I'll call him that though, and he wanders the neighborhood wanting to talk to people. All right? And I'll come in after a long day, and I'll park, and I'll see him coming. I'm going, no, not my driveway. Please don't walk down my driveway. I don't want to talk to you right now. I've talked to people all day. I need alone time. And so sometimes I'll even dodge so I don't have to engage him. But that's not good. You know what that's a sign of in my life? It's a sign of traveling too fast. Because during his 3 years of ministry, Jesus was riddled with interruptions. We saw two this morning. But it's, you know what? It's fair to say that if you were to read the Gospels, you would see that his ministry was largely a response to interruptions. Jesus didn't have real interruptions in his life. Oh, there were things in his life that seemed like interruptions, but interruptions represented people. And people were one of his key priorities. And so interruptions represented people and their needs. And so he always had time for them. Jesus saw interruptions as opportunities to display his Father's power and love and grace. And Jesus wants us, his followers, to look at interruptions the same way. The great priest, Henry Nouwen, had an interesting conversation one day about interruptions that changed the way he looked at interruptions. Here's what Henry Nouwen wrote. While visiting the University of Notre Dame, where I'd been a teacher for a few years, I met an older, experienced professor who had spent most of his life there. And while we strolled over the beautiful campuses, he said, with a certain melancholy in his voice, "You know, my whole life, I've been complaining my work was constantly interrupted until I discovered that interruptions were my work." Have you ever thought that life happens in the interruptions? What if we saw interruptions in a whole new light, as opportunities for Jesus to display his power and his love and his grace through you? You know, as I was preparing for this series, and as I mentioned, I went to the elders. I said, we got to slow this train down a little bit for my life. And as I peeled back and had a little more time, one of the things I've been praying about is that I'm going to have some great conversations with Frank this summer. And that when I see Frank wandering into my driveway, I know there's a guy that's lonely and wants to talk. And I'm going to create some margin for him in my life. I'm going to see Frank interrupting my weed eating the garden or my whatever I'm doing, washing my car, as opportunities for God to work through me and touch Frank with his love and grace. Life happens in the interruptions. And so this week, as we think about loving our neighbors, here's what I want you to think about: three things. Number one, I want you to keep planning that neighborhood barbecue. That is a great way to love your neighbors, great way to get to know your neighbors. Secondly, again, this week, take a couple of prayer walks. Walk your husband, walk your dog in the neighborhood, and pray as you do it. And remember, Jesus wants to work through you to bring life and healing to your neighbor and your neighborhood. But for that to happen, two things need to happen. You need to be able to spend time in your neighborhood. You need to find some time like Jesus did so that you can spend time investing in your neighborhood, investing in your neighbors, allow them to interrupt your life. How are you going to do that? The other thing you need to know is you need to know Jesus is the life giver. You need to know Jesus. You need to be walking humbly with him every day that your feet are on this planet so he can pour his love and his grace and his power through you to touch others. Know Jesus. Walk with Jesus. I'd love to talk to you. Rick would love to talk to you. Others would love to talk to you about getting to know Jesus. Know Jesus, the life giver, and then allow him to give life through you to others as you keep your eye on the prize and don't miss the point. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for your amazing love and grace. Thank you for your goodness. Thank you for the story. You are the life giver, and I pray that everyone in this room would know a touch from you, that they would know that you are the life giver, that they would walk out these doors going, Jesus is my life giver. And then, God, may you pour your love, your grace, your power through us to touch the lives of others. God, allow us to keep the main point, the main point. Don't let us be like Darren Hardy's friend who missed the point. God, on that day when we're breathing our last, may we know that we kept the main point, the main thing, that we loved you and we loved others. And God, allow our schedules to reflect that so that we can slow down, so that we can allow interruptions in our lives, so you can use us to touch others and to breathe your life into their lives. In Jesus' name, amen.